Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Cheese and Pickle. Hello, this is Comfort Blanket. I'm Joel Morris. I'm going to be talking to someone who makes cool stuff that I like about some warm stuff that they like. A book or a TV show or a film or a record that they return to again and again because they know it will never let them down. Something warm and safe. No guilty pleasures, just really good stuff. And we'll have a little look at it and try and work out where the magic gets in and how it works. This time I'm talking to the comedian and writer Tom Neenan. Tom is a very good stand-up and is the creator of Radio 4's The Hauntening, has written for the News Quiz and the MASH Report and writes loads of stuff like that. It's very funny. And he has chosen for his comfort blanket the film Jurassic Park.
Dr. Grant, my dear Dr. Sattler, welcome to Jurassic Park.
Right, this is very exciting because we're doing Spielberg. And initially, the idea for this podcast was to do Spielberg every week and not let anyone on who didn't choose Spielberg. So we're going to do Spielberg and we're going to do Jurassic Park.
I'm so excited.
And the only response to that is to go, Jurassic Park!
Jurassic Park!
As loudly as possible. Jurassic Park. This is a brilliant suggestion because I think this is the world's most comforting monster movie.
It really is. And I have to say, the first time I saw it, it was the most scared I'd ever been by the cinema in
really?
My life. Proper like, my parents said, do you want to leave? And I was like, no, I hate this, but I'm in my chair and I don't want to get up. It was, yeah.
Because that's a big moment for kids, I think. The first time you realise that being scared is okay.
Yes, yeah.
Jurassic Park, as an exercise in scaring children.
Yeah.
That's all it's about. It's about making children scream.
It's precision engineered, I think, to do that. You've got everything from abandonment from an adult figure who is then immediately dispatched.
He left us.
To then, like, being on your own and having to negotiate it yourself. And I remember like the kitchen scene specifically being something where I was like, I can't believe you're allowed to show, like, as a kid being like, but they could die and how is this allowed to be seen? And I loved it. I thought it was incredible.
It's just the two raptors, Ray. Are you sure the third one's contained?
Yes. Unless they figured out how to open doors.
It's a strange film in that it is just about vulnerable children. And the first thing that you see Sam Neill do is scare a child.
Yeah.
And that's when the attack comes, not from the front, but from the side. Because Velociraptor's a pack hunter, you see. He uses coordinated attack patterns, and he is out in force today. And he slashes at you with this 6-inch retractable claw, like a razor.
Because he's like selling the threat, right? I love that bit, because in a PG-13, I guess you can't show guts spilling out, but you can show a man telling you that guts will spill out and go, so in the future, this thing that we're talking about, if you see it, that's what it'll do to you.
Yeah.
He doesn't bother to bite your jugular like a lion, say. No, no. He slashes at you here or here.
And that is created in your image, in your mind, where you're thinking, oh, okay, velociraptors will do the most awful stuff to you when they turn up.
People talk about Spielberg as the ultimate storyteller and things. But one of the things he does is he tells stories in that way. He tells stories using storytelling.
Yes.
The moment you see Dennis Nedry run off into the woods and you know he's gone to the Dilophosaurus paddock, you remember earlier on someone told you what Dilophosauruses do. They spit poison and they can kill you.
One of the earliest carnivores, we now know Dilophosaurus is actually poisonous, spitting its venom at its prey, causing blindness and eventually paralysis.
And it's just, each bit of it is like a campfire story where an older brother said, if you go, there's a guy with a hook for a head.
Now, lethal at 8 months, and I do mean lethal. I've hunted most things that can hunt you, but the way these things move...
How fast for a biped?
Cheetah speed. 50, 60 miles per hour if they ever got out in the open. And they're astonishing jumpers.
Yes. So that's why we're taking extreme precautions.
It's a scary story.
Yeah, everything is prefigured. And I wish there was. I do wish there was more of that. I don't want this to be railing on current cinema. Things are different, and I embrace that. But part of me thinks I wish there was a bit more time before a monster turned up. That there was just a brilliant character actor with a brilliant voice saying why that monster or that thing is awful.
When she looks at you, you can see she's working things out. That's why we have to feed them like this. She had them all attacking the fences when the feeders came.
The fences are electrified, though, right?
That's right, but they never attacked the same place twice. They were testing the fences for weaknesses systematically.
That whole speech is just about, oh, these predators are the worst predators you've ever met, and if you're in a kitchen with them, you are dead. And that's all it's selling, isn't it?
Why I think everyone worships this blockbuster Spielberg-y storytelling style is its enormous clarity.
Your investors, whom I represent, are deeply concerned. 48 hours from now, if they're not convinced, I'm not convinced. Shut you down, John.
Yes.
And when you see something built on this formula without the clarity, you find yourself feeling like you've been let down. And Jurassic Park is a terrific example of a lot of exposition being dumped very clearly so you know exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
Dr. Wu inserted a gene that creates a single faulty enzyme in protein metabolism. The animals can't manufacture the amino acid lysine. Unless they're completely supplied with lysine by us, they slip into a coma and die.
I love it, and it means that you can buy into it. Mr. DNA is an amazing bit of, you know, it's an exposition dump, but it's entertaining. And I watched it yesterday, and I was like, you are the person who goes, visits Jurassic Park, and it watches the animation, explains it all, and then we're off to the races. And then you're like, okay, I buy it all because it's been told in an authentic way, I guess, even though it's nonsense.
A DNA strand, like me, is a blueprint for building a living thing. And sometimes animals that went extinct millions of years ago, like dinosaurs, left their blueprints behind for us to find.
There's a lot of embedded exposition in this. There's a lot of stuff where something is happening while someone's talking.
Yeah.
And they're probably dumping most of the book. I've not read the novel, but David Koepp, who wrote the screenplay for this, has done a really good job taking a lot of quite, I imagine, arcane chaos theory and things and dropped it into the mouths of people who are doing an interesting thing while they dump exposition. At the most basic level, to stop you asking, hang on, dinosaurs, how did they come back?
But again, how do you know they're all female? Or does somebody go out in the park and pull up the dinosaur's skirts?
We control their chromosomes.
There's not that much more going on than stopping you asking how the impossible thing is happening.
Yeah.
It's really not that difficult.
But it's enough to make you suspend disbelief
100%.
And go on the ride.
Yeah. They know it's the perfect amount. I always get annoyed when, you know, when people say, like, you spot a flaw in something, and they always pick on the big thing and go, well, if you believe that a man can fly around and pretend to be a bat, then you'll believe this. And it's like, well, no, the film has made me believe this aspect of it. Yeah. And actually, I've bought into that, but it hasn't made me buy into this aspect. And what this does is at every stage go, are you okay with dinosaurs or bat? Okay, right, now we're going to move on to this bit and this bit. And it always makes sure you're along for the ride, you're right.
Yeah, and the science is really, really good pop science.
Yeah.
It's the level of do your own research. It makes sense to someone who doesn't understand science.
Yeah.
I'll tell you the problem with the scientific power that you're using here. It didn't require any discipline to attain it.
A scientist would go, whoa, you can't do that. But when you get to the level of throwing away, we spliced in the missing bits of DNA with frog DNA.
Yeah.
And you're, fine.
And then
when that turns out to be an explanation for something else you were asking, it's really good at fridge logic.
Jurassic Park.
Anything you're going to go home and go, wait, hang on, I now buy this ride.
Yes, yeah.
The shooting of it is clear enough, and the staging of it, as always with Spielberg, it's beautifully storyboarded and beautifully made.
Yeah.
That you don't ask questions while you're being thrilled.
But yeah, exactly.
Okay, that's not too bad right there.
Yes, it is.
It's just like coming out of a treehouse. Did your dad ever build you a treehouse?
No.
Damn it. The thing about climbing is you never, never look down.
This
never.
Is impossible.
So?
How am I going to do this?
Okay. I'm going to help you with the footing. Oh, no. Damn it. Go.
And, like, that whole sequence, I mean, we can probably talk in detail about that paddock sequence, which I think is just one of the most perfectly constructed cinematic sequences ever. It doesn't make sense, and it doesn't matter, but you go, oh, where is the paddock on a... Is it sort of on the ground level, or do you dip into it? And how
yes,
does it...
I noticed that. They climb down and up, and I go, I don't care, because
yeah,
I'm having
yeah,
fun.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I think the logic of Jurassic Park is pretty much foolproof for a fairground ride.
Yes, it does everything it needs to.
That's what you're strapping in for, and I think it's... A really good example, exactly like Raid of the Lost Ark is. It's a fairground ride you agree to get on at the beginning.
Yeah.
It tests how tall you are. Mm-hmm. Are you a grown-up enough to get on this ride? Yeah. Usually by doing something horrible at the beginning.
Nice.
Like you have Alfred Molina gets an arrow in his head and you go, oh, I'm too young for this, I won't watch it.
Yeah.
Or someone gets eaten by a velociraptor. If you want to join the ride starts.
Yes.
And at the end of it, you get a photograph of you going, ooh, and that's all you're signing up for.
Yeah, yeah.
Can't you stop these things?
I'm sorry, it's kind of a ride.
One, two, three.
You can't do that. Can they do that?
And that is as it should be. That is like the most thrilling bit. And then out as soon as you can possibly get out of that thing. There's a culture of like YouTubers and people whose job it is to go, who get subscribers going, 15 things that you wouldn't have spotted in this film. And, you know, I watch those. I really like them.
Earlier we saw the T-Rex standing next to this fence, and then suddenly there's a huge cliff that is way the f*** deeper than a T-Rex is tall.
But I make sure they don't affect the actual enjoyment of the film, if that makes sense. So if you're going, like, the ending of X Explained or whatever, that is an addition to it and fun to watch, but I think there should be clear water between the actual media they're discussing and stuff like that. Otherwise it gets a bit, sort of, eat its own tail.
Jurassic Park Tour blows its wad early by putting the T-Rex paddock on the second stop of the tour. Any self-respecting theme park would know to put the T-Rex last.
I was watching this last night wondering, with these sort of, especially these kind of thrill rides, where it's a thrill ride, but I've seen it hundreds of times, dozens of times maybe.
Yeah.
Why am I still enjoying it?
Mm.
And I think there comes a point in experiencing... Like possibly it is with comedy, where it stops making you laugh and it starts just delighting you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because you know what's coming next. Mm-hmm. And I was watching this last night going, I am delighting now at watching how it's doing it.
Yes.
And I think there comes a point, if you're a fan of this stuff, where the comfort doesn't come from how it was the first time round, where you were too terrified to leave the cinema.
Yeah.
But in wondering at the craft and the art and the enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
And it is exactly like if you went on a roller coaster again and again and again.
Yeah.
And you knew where the bit that made you sick was. You'd start appreciating how cleverly built it
was. Yes, yeah.
When they opened Disneyland in 1956, nothing worked.
Yeah,
nothing.
But John, if the Pirates of the Caribbean breaks down, the pirates don't eat the tourists.
I can't wait anymore. Something went wrong.
I wonder if the comfort of watching a thriller again and again and again is after a while you stop being frightened and you start being delighted.
By the sheer sort of just the ingenuity and the engineering. Lots of people talk about engineering in this film. It's like someone says, oh, we're in the hands of engineers. And it's like, there is that element where it's just precision built.
God help us, we're in the hands of engineers.
One of the things people say about this is obviously there's not a lot of CGI in the film. And there's only like 8 minutes of dinosaurs.
It's 6 minutes of CGI.
Right.
And the rest of I remember making this mistake once with John Luke Roberts saying, there's only 6 minutes of real dinosaurs in it. Yeah. And he went, real dinosaurs? Yeah, not real. There's only 6 minutes of CGI dinosaurs, which was the big technological leap forward.
Mm-hmm.
This is 1993. No one had done this before. This is brand new technology.
Yeah.
There's a lot of astonishing on-set puppetry and animatronics. There's a fair amount of dinosaurs in it, but six minutes of impossible, never been seen before.
Yes.
Wow.
We all started to plan it out as the conventional stop motion, go motion, rod puppet.
And then one day I got a call from Dennis Muren at ILM, and Dennis said that he thought that he could pull off a full-size dinosaur that would be authentic to the eye. And the first test he did was a whole herd of Gallimimus running through a still photograph of Hawaii. And it was so authentic and smooth, I actually said, well, that's the future. That's the way it's going to be from now on.
Anytime you can see something's legs,
that
usually that's CGI. Though the big Tyrannosaurus stamp, it's stamping in the mud, That is the most massive machine.
Don't move. You can't see us if we don't move.
Amazing.
Most of the time, mm-hmm. if something's running around, it's CGI.
A videotape came from ILM, and we saw this image of what they had done, and we're just, wow, everything changed.
That's where they got We're Extinct, wasn't it? Said that, and then they gave that to Jeff Goldblum.
It was April 20th, 1992. I remember we called it Black Monday because we got the word that production was going digital.
At that point in time, it's like emotional, big emotional moments, like, you know, when your dog dies. Because it did seem like everything that I had built up until that time was like, we're not going to do it that way anymore.
You know, it's like suddenly, you know, here we are, we're extinct. You know, we're the dinosaurs.
But there's only 6 minutes of those.
Yeah.
So actually, there's not a lot of dinosaur in it.
No.
And there's certainly not a lot of the big selling point, which is you've never seen dinosaurs like this before. Which makes it even more astonishing, because then it becomes a feat of storytelling, I think.
It really does. I think what I was looking out for this time is I was thinking, okay, because watching it now, and I watched it last night, what I was astounded by is it doesn't feel like it's lacking. It doesn't feel like when you watch a certain black and white film or something, you go, okay, for the time, the pacing is different. It feels like you wouldn't feel shortchanged if this came out tomorrow.
Oddly, I think it's got enough old-fashionedness. Now it's 25, 30 years old. It does feel part of the Jaws tradition.
Right, yeah.
Rather than part of the Marvel, Godzilla, The Rock movies. It doesn't feel like a 21st century film. It feels like it's got solid storytelling. It trusts you to listen.
It
trusts you to wait.
Yeah.
In a way that I think a film nowadays would probably be dancing around, jiggling about a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't feel slow or don't feel shortchanged.
No.
You don't feel like there's no dinosaurs.
Now
eventually you do plan to have dinosaurs on your dinosaur tour, right? Hello?
I really hate that man.
The first note I made was watching the beginning of it, which is that astonishing scene where it opens.
Yeah.
And again, pure Spielberg. There's a whoosh of something in foliage, but it's not a dinosaur.
Yeah.
It's a box, which is brilliant. And then you've got Bob Peck, lots and lots of torches, classic Spielberg, people with light sources. All Spielberg films are about people holding lights because that's how films are made. There has to be a light source.
Definitely.
So he's fascinated by where the light comes from. There's a monster, and the monster in the box grabs someone and violently yanks them. And I went, oh, Jaws.
Oh, of course.
The opening of Jaws
is
you can't see what's attacked someone,
but
they get pulled one way or another.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, God, this is Jaws 2.
Yeah.
All this is, he's got a thing, he's got a technology, a monster, and the monster doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because it's 1993 and a CGI dinosaur doesn't work.
Yes, yeah.
Far beyond where we were technologically in 1973, 74 with Jaws.
And all the rest of the film is about battling the fact that the monster he wants to show you, he can't quite show you.
Yeah.
So every trick from Jaws is then pulled in to do Land Shark.
Yeah. It's genius.
Clever girl.
All the distractions that make Jaws amazing, an amazing monster movie, are in this film.
Definitely. Even if you think about that first shot and about the guy who gets yanked, I don't know how you square what a velociraptor is able to do when you watch it later and what it's doing to that man there. Because he somehow levitates him for a bit. You're like, well, that's not what they can do. But all you're seeing is a powerful thing showing that man is nothing, is a ragdoll to them.
Spielberg says something really interesting about this. He said it's not a monster movie.
Right.
Jurassic Park wasn't a monster movie. It was a movie about animals.
I'm glad they didn't go for the monster is capitalism or something.
And Spielberg said, I didn't want to make a monster movie. I wanted to make an animal movie.
Oh.
And I thought, yes, you're right.
Yeah.
They don't do anything evil.
No.
It's life finds a way. They just do what's natural.
Mm-hmm.
It's a film about lions.
Yeah.
In a way that I think Jaws is slightly more about a monster.
It is. There's a malevolence that they sort of imbue it with, isn't there?
And this one, it stops at, this is just nature, don't fuck with it.
Arguably an issue that they now have with the newer films is that by the end, the T-Rex is the hero because it saves them.
Yes.
So it's all going, oh no, that thing that you were terrified of a while back is just being what it is.
Yeah.
And it just happens to be helpful this time that it wants to eat the velociraptors.
That's an enormously satisfying ending, weirdly. And you do punch the air when it grabs the velociraptors threatening them. Though, this time, the first time I noticed that, what's the deal with the T-Rex? You can hear it coming.
Yeah.
And suddenly it's there out of nowhere. It's tiptoed in.
Yeah.
But again, because of the moment, mm-hmm. you forgive it because of the drama.
Yeah.
I noticed this time around the anticipation for the T-Rex, and again, why this is Jaws 2.
Mm-hmm.
What does it do? It goes...
Yeah.
Bum, 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 bum.
Yes.
So every time that the vibration of the, mm-hmm. the glass or the vibration of the mirror,
yeah.
it's exactly the thing from Jaws is before it arrives. Mm-hmm. And it's never a false alarm.
No.
That was the rule with Jaws, wasn't it? If you heard mm-hmm. the theme music,
it's there.
It was going to be there. It's a lovely trick, and it's just the same thing. The shark's coming.
Maybe it's the power trying to come back on.
Fascinatingly, to sort of compare it to Jaws in that sense, is that John Williams cuts out. There is no score on that paddock thing.
Really?
So like you say, you've got the rhythm. The rhythm is there,
yeah.
but it relies on the natural rhythm, and there's no...
Wow.
John Williams is absent, obviously, all the way through this, one of my favourite John Williams scores ever.
It's a great one.
I think, did I hear somewhere that like he had these two themes, and he went, which one do you want? And they're like, well, both of them. So you got the... And you've also got... And so they both exist. But yeah, I was watching it and I was going, oh, that whole paddock set piece is like, there's no John Williams in it because
wow.
they're just letting it play out. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting.
You can feel sort of lost in that. It's a trick you notice in action movies that when you've got a big theme, when they don't use the Bond theme, and it's just... scored with Foley, and you realise that your soundtrack you're playing with in these films, this is Gary Rydstrom doing the sound effects on this,
right.
that sometimes you're just allowing that guy to be your composer.
Yeah.
It's just the Foley guy, and mm-hmm. It's a combination of things, and that the T-Rex sounds are all brilliant.
Yeah.
The footsteps, which are, I think they're big trees falling over.
Oh, is that right?
He went to record some lumberjacks, and they're giant cedars falling over. Every time the foot comes on, it's a tree falling down.
Yeah.
And the roar is lions at the base end. And baby elephants at the top for the squeal.
Nice.
So it's just, where did the baby elephant gives it a softness?
Yeah,
it is a baby. It's a mewling sound. And you go, oh, it's not just a threatening alpha gorilla bear. It's a at the top. And you go, oh. And the way they do the monsters, you feel for all of them.
Yeah.
There's a huge empathy. Again, it's not a monster movie. You don't look in the eye of the T-Rex and blame it.
No, not at all.
And that's done with puppetry. I mean, giant puppetry.
Yeah.
No one says it's anything more than a big beast.
Yeah.
Bob Peck says it's cleverer than you think.
Yeah.
The threatening thing is that they're crows.
Yeah.
I just didn't realise that. They go, oh, they're birds. And you went, oh, if they're birds, then they're toolmakers and they're intelligent. And
right, yeah.
And as soon as the velociraptors are pulling at the door handles, you go, oh, God, they're crows. Now we're in trouble. It's the birds at that point.
Yeah.
Clever girl.
Well, even the bit where they drop the cow and suddenly they all descend on it and they're like, it is quite bird-like, isn't it? It's quite crow, just like taking the food and pecking at it and sort of stripping it.
Yeah, in fact, that's a thing I hadn't noticed, is that a lot of the threat comes from our fear of the way birds work, the way the birds dart their eyes about and things.
Yes.
And you go, there's an intelligence here, but it's not human intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm worried about it because when the velociraptors come into the kitchen, they go, as long as they can't open doors,
you
know, or they can do a human thing. And I went, it's not a human thing. That's the thing we're scared animals might do.
Right, yeah. It's true, yeah, that bird thing, when Dennis Nedry has got is it Dilophosaurus with the
Dilophosaurus that's going to spit at him.
Yes, and it's being very cute and it's chirping, isn't it? It's chirping and it's sort of playing with him, because then you realise that what it's doing is, it's like being harmless and it's being sort of lovely and then knowing it can get him at any moment.
Yeah, and then obviously the great finale, again, it's all good decisions.
Mm.
It would be scary if it killed him outside in the jungle.
Yeah.
What's scary is it's in the car.
God, yes.
We're all scared about a bird getting in the car or a wasp getting in the car.
Yeah.
It's about the human fear of there's an animal in the car. Mm.
There's that weird moment where he hits his head, and it's a comedy beat in what is like we know at that point he's sort of doomed, isn't he?
Yeah.
But like they go... Wayne Knight's a very skilled comedy actor, and
really
funny. They let him do pratfalls in this thing where it's like deadly to do a pratfall. I love that.
It judges, I mean, in terms of you saying this is the really first really scary movie you saw as a kid, it judges throughout when it needs to not be scary.
Yeah.
When it needs you to know that this is a laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got I was wondering at the script.
Mm.
It is full of good one-liners.
Yeah.
It's very quotable.
Uh-huh.
It's full of good lines you still remember.
Yeah.
Lots of them are expositional but beautifully expositional, but it's full of good, wisecracking gags, and they all land.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
We're back in the car again.
It's just a great punchline, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. We're back in the car.
Yeah.
And it's just that it's always about deflating the threat.
Mm.
Just at the moment you're going, is it all right to breathe out?
Boy, my head being right all the time.
And then you get the wisecrack.
Yeah.
And that's a skill. When you see a film that uses wisecracks badly, so it deflates the thing in the middle of the scene, when this judges in a symphonic way when to lift and when to drop the audience.
Definitely.
And wisecracks. David Koepp's script is full of good wisecracks that arrive to let you know if the kids can joke and the grown-ups can joke, they're not that scared.
Now where does he think he's going? When you gotta go, you gotta go.
That's lovely.
It's very good.
And it's a way of, I guess, having the rhythm of a set piece. It's a film where the set piece is just beautifully constructed. Similarly, so at the same time that you've got We're Back in the Car, you've got Jeff Goldblum, just as they've just escaped the T-Rex, going, they're going to have that on the tour?
Yes, perfect.
It's just like, at a punchline, that scene is over, and we all are going to, and now we're going to reset for the next piece.
We can probably return to, again, Rufus Jones's point about saying it's a Jewish sense of humour.
Yeah.
So you're going to do that on the tour? You can do all of them in the voice of Jackie Mason. So we're back in the car.
Yeah.
Hammond. After careful consideration, I've decided not to endorse your park.
They're all deflating threat.
Yeah.
It's all that classic Jewish gallows humour in the face of black
horror. My God. I'm now thinking of all of it. I'm thinking of, like, Tim getting electrocuted, getting flung off.
One. Two.
He's dead for a second. He's not breathing. They bring him round. He goes, ugh.
Good boy.
Three.
And yeah. That's like the end of a scene. It's a perfect punchline.
That I wrote down, I think that's my most underrated scene in Jurassic Park, is climbing the electric fence.
Yeah, yeah.
I think everyone forgets, and all it needs is Laura Dern is pushing a load of buttons, and you know the last button is kill children. It's marked dead kid.
Yeah.
This is Hitchcock threat.
Yeah.
The audience know at which point, it's like the bomb going off in Saboteur. You know what's going to happen. The bomb has been seen and it just paces you, going, don't. And then brilliantly, and I forget this every time, they do zap the kid.
Yeah.
I keep thinking he's going to jump.
No.
I always misremember it. They don't. There's sparks off his hands. Mm-hmm. They do the thing you're not expecting.
Yeah.
But you've been building to it and you gasp and then a joke.
Yeah. Brilliant. Oh, it's symphonic, isn't it? The way that that's all put together.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Like most Spielberg, it's incredibly cinema literate.
Yeah.
The line,
what do they got in there, King Kong?
It's saying, we're just going through the gates from King Kong.
Mm.
It knows you've seen monster movies before. It knows you know the rules of monster movies.
Yeah.
It knows you love monster movies, which is why you've come to see this film.
Yeah.
It's totally happy to play by the rules.
Mm.
And it's not doing that because it's lazy. It's doing that because it wants to make you happy.
Yeah.
And it's got a puppyish desire to give you what you want. So you see Bob Peck. You know he will be killed by the monsters he looks after.
Yes, yeah.
Because he's part of that world. It's a film about filmmaking, and it's a film about thrills, and it's a film about thrill rides. It's that great thing going, it's about a theme park.
Yeah.
It's about some people. It is a film about some people who come to see dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Which is shown to people who've come to see dinosaurs. And
perfect.
My overall thing about Spielberg all the time is Spielberg puts the audience on screen.
Yes.
The biggest character in all Spielberg films is someone who is delighted to see all the stuff. That crucial scene in Jurassic Park is taking your sunglasses off to look at the most awesome dinosaurs. And that shot of Laura Dern and Sam mm-hmm. Neill seeing the dinosaurs comes before you have the same look on your face as they do.
Yeah.
It's full of cued looks. And it's a film about watching films. And it's a film about riding fairground rides. And it's a film about the thrill of watching.
Yes.
To the extent that the opening of the film, where nothing turns up, mm-hmm. you're watching people bored because there are no dinosaurs. Are you going to have dinosaurs in your dinosaur park?
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. I'm on screen. There's me. I'm saying that. Where are the dinosaurs?
He's articulated the thing, yeah. And it's... That's incredible. It sells the awe, which is what it has to do all the time by sort of going, and there was a meta thing to do with, like, at the time, not necessarily now, is the meta thing is going, look what a cinema maker can do.
Yes.
So you're also Sam Neill, but for a different reason. You're also going, oh my God, he did it.
Did Spielberg actually do it? Yeah. Constantly, the number of times that Spielberg is John Hammond.
Yeah, yeah.
Rich Attenborough, who is a film director, is on screen, and Spielberg has put a film director on screen, and he tells the flea circus story.
You know the first... attraction I ever built when I came down from Scotland. It's a flea circus, Petticoat Lane. Really quite wonderful. We had a wee trapeze and carousel. They all move, motorised of course, but people would say they could see the fleas. Oh, I can see the fleas, Mummy, can't you see the fleas? But this place... I wanted to show them something that wasn't an illusion. Something that was real.
That's of no interest to anyone in the cinema.
Yeah.
Unless you're Steven Spielberg or aware of the career of Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
That's a story about being a film director. He knows mm-hmm. all he's come out to Hawaii to film is empty plates. There are no fleas in his flea circus. Yeah, it is just an illusion.
My dad would always take me to see the dinosaurs in Philadelphia, the Franklin Institute of Technology. There was a natural history museum there with big dinosaur bones. And so I made that movie really as a youngster, remembering how much fun it was to imagine with such yearning that someday wouldn't it be great to run into a dinosaur.
And it comes a long way into the film when you've been delighted by being fooled by the illusion. He says, you know, there's no monsters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just the levels on which the film is talking about the process of filmmaking and the process of wonder and the process of ballyhoo, circuses and things. Mm-hmm.
And I just remember making the movie with that philosophy for everybody that had ever wondered and been fascinated with that whole era of the dinosaur. I want to make a movie for all those dinosaur lovers.
I noticed something. This is my pretentious thing.
Okay,
go for it. Maybe we have a pretentious collection.
Sure.
The first dinosaur you see, and this had never occurred to me until this time around, the first dinosaur you see isn't a T-Rex or a Velociraptor.
Mm.
The first dinosaur you see is a big sauropod.
Yeah.
A big Brachiosaurus.
Mm-hmm.
The first animated cartoon ever was Winsor McKay's Gertie the Dinosaur.
Right.
In which Winsor McKay, in the guise of John Hammond, like he is with Mr. DNA, would come out on screen, the cartoonist who created Little Nemo, would come out in front of a cinema screen and go, ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Gertie the Dinosaur, and an animated dinosaur that he'd drawn by hand.
Yeah.
So the dinosaur would then step out and interact with him, and he'd do all the pricking your finger thing.
Yeah.
It was like a vaudeville entertainment. And Winsor McKay was employed by William Randolph Hearst, who banned him from doing it. He said, I don't want my cartoonist doing vaudeville. But it was a vaudeville act. And he would perform with a fake brachiosaur or a brontosaur behind him, with whom he'd interact, and she would do. And he said he chose a dinosaur because then people wouldn't think it was just a traced animal.
Yeah.
He said, I did it because it was impossible.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
And you realise the first dinosaur you see it, and they interact with the brachiosaur, and I went, oh my God, it's Gertie the Dinosaur. This is the history of cinema.
Yeah.
The history of animation, the history of illusion, the history of dinosaurs on film. It's completely cinema literate.
Yeah.
And you know, like, if Spielberg doesn't know that, then Phil Tippett knows it. And Stan Winston knows it. The special effects guys know.
Yeah.
If you put dinosaurs on screen, you're referencing Gertie the Dinosaur. So the first one you see is a big, gentle sauropod, because that's the history of this as a medium.
Yeah,
People went to the cinema to see Impossible Dinosaurs in 1914, and this is the same. It's a circus act.
I love it. I'm like, you're absolutely right. It's the meta thing runs all the way through from the point where, like you were saying, the biggest animatronic puppet at the time ever made was the T-Rex.
Yes.
Which is a dangerous thing anyway.
Yeah.
Like the fact that when, you know, when Lex and Sam Neill are like looking up at this thing, there's a thing with the actors where, like, oh, if that thing that, you know, misfires, then that is very dangerous. And it's like, there is
There's hydraulics everywhere. There's a great bit where you see, I think it's in Jurassic Park 2, if you watch the making of it, there's the two T-Rexes. Mm. And Stan Winston, before they do the shot, he goes, please stand clear. This is heavy plant machinery. It'll take your head off. And you go, what, like a T-Rex?
Yeah, yeah.
Don't stand near the digger. It's just a digger and we've thrown a canvas over it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As soon as you realise how much puppetry's in it, the performances make a lot more sense.
Yes.
And it's actually more fun.
Yeah, yeah.
Because a lot of the time they're just being hit by emu. The velociraptors are basically emu attacks. Yeah. It's just someone with a hand and a beak going bang, bang, bang. And the fact that a lot of this isn't CGI, I think, makes it more delightful. Has helped it not date, I think.
I think so. I think it's when you watch, you know, on the list as well was all of the Mission Impossible films, like a run of those. That easily a comfort blanket, which I think Tom Cruise has realised that in a world of CGI where you can achieve anything, he's gone, oh, the thing that you buy into is it's me doing it.
Yeah.
And to what extent, I don't know how much actually you can have him doing those things, but you go, the spectacle is now seeing one of the most famous men in the world almost about to die for real.
And it's pure Houdini. And again, we're taking a thing. We're taking cinema back to cinema used to be done on the back of a wagon.
Yeah.
We'd turn up and then and a man would go, ladies and gentlemen, a train will pull in at a station. Come and sit. We're back there.
Yeah.
And I love the honouring of what cinema was that's in this. It's just, it's a ride. It becomes a theme park. It uses theme park technology, as in those big animatronics are.
They're
only that good because they were doing them in Disney World.
Yeah,
this is again. Critics go, "Oh, it's just a theme park ride." And you went, "Just a theme park ride."
The most hard, but like, something incredibly difficult to construct, engineer, and make
a
work.
A piece of miraculous engineering that's done brilliantly, and also, do you know what cinema is? It is a sideshow entertainment.
Yeah, it always
was. Come and see an impossible thing that 2 weeks previously was impossible to do in cinema.
Yes.
This is brand new technology.
What I'd like to do, because I don't know sort of, I'm assuming sort of creative people listen to this, and I want to sort of say, there's an argument that is made about overuse of CGI and things, which I know that CGI artists rail against.
Yeah.
Because I think what happens is incredibly talented people who make the, you know, invisible CGI stuff, like that we don't even notice, that aren't monsters and things, are then given 4 weeks to, because they're non-union, to like, basically fill a film that's all green screen.
Yes.
And it suffers. Well, obviously this is like the attention given to every frame is evident in this. And I'm not sure often that can sort of slip through the net in modern cinema making because it's so easy, you know, because in inverted commas, it's easy. All that means is the rendering time, I guess, is like slashed in. You
the
know.
Computers are more powerful, but the craft of this, I didn't realize as well how they'd done the animation.
Right.
That they'd invented a digital programming device for programming the motion of the computer puppets.
Yeah.
And it was an armature.
Oh, like in animation.
Like Jason and the Argonauts or Wallace and Gromit. It was a load of connected bits of Meccano in the shape of Velociraptor, and you move them a frame at a time, and then it programs the computer with what you've done.
Yeah.
So effectively, all you've done is exactly the same as Ray Harryhausen or Wallace and Gromit. So the same craft, the same craftsman, but it then renders it as a computer thing. And they did it by developing a little armature that you move and it programs what the dinosaur's going to do. One of the things that's incredible about this film is that computer system that Dennis Nedry gives them.
You know anybody who can network 8 connection machines and debug 2 million lines of code for what I bid for this job?
Yeah.
The really bad one, the really clunky one that you look at now and go, Jurassic Park's run on this awful.
Yeah.
And then you realise, oh my God, the dinosaurs were programmed on a computer like this.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Because it shows you what computers look like in 1993. And he went, what? You did the T-Rex on that?
You think that kind of automation is easy?
As far as I'm aware, Spielberg's never gone back, has he? He's never gone back and gone, there are bits, you know, where he could fix it. He's never touched it. And I think, because George Lucas works on this, right? He did some, I think, sort of post things. I believe that he sort of, he's fascinated by
it. He's a tech guy, isn't he? Exactly, he's always a tech guy.
But obviously he's known for going back and fixing various bits of, you know, the CGI and things for him. But like, but Spielberg's gone, no, even though I'm sure now you could make it look like absolutely seamless, he's gone, no, that's the version of it that works and is perfect.
I mean, he's lucky in that I think it just looks brilliant.
Yeah.
It doesn't look dated. Mm. Weirdly, this is a good look.
Yeah.
We're used to CGI dinosaurs and it looks like CGI dinosaurs. Mm. I don't question it. It's not, I think as well, because we don't know what dinosaurs look like.
True. Yeah.
If it was a CGI lion or a dog, we might have got a better CGI lion or a dog by now. But these dinosaurs look like CGI dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And I go, that's what dinosaurs look like because I very rarely see real ones.
Yeah.
And not anymore.
Maybe it's because Spielberg told us what dinosaurs look like for a degree, you know, where he took references and then was like, yeah, this from now on is sort of the gold standard for what a dinosaur looks like on screen.
That was all new.
Yes.
Because we'd all grown up seeing sort of big lumping mm-hmm. lizards like the Crystal Palace dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Whereas now we all know that's what dinosaurs look like. Even mm-hmm. they maybe they aren't because technology's come on.
Yes, a bit smaller, covered in feathers or whatever.
It's all wrong.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
At the time, this was the first time you'd seen dinosaurs move like this, the bird-like look, the ostrich mm-hmm. look, the strange sort of darting heads and things.
Mm.
And when you watch the making of, they have a load of designers who come and say, yes, I designed the T-Rex. Mm. No, God designed the T-Rex. But they did. They invented that. That's not a thing that existed before someone drew it.
It makes it, and like you can see the artistry in that face, in that T-Rex face with the arched eye, sort of artificially arched eyebrows in inverted commas, or whatever it is, that skull shape. And like it's an iconic monster, and it is designed. Because also I guess they had to go, here's what it would look like, but also here's how we're gonna make the mouth open for the puppet as well. So it kind of all
Every decision's been made. Again, the joy and comfort of these kind of movies is you're just enjoying craft.
Yes, yeah.
And when you talk about craft, what you're enjoying is decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What decisions have been made and how pleasing are those decisions? Mm. And like any piece of art, when you look at a painting, it's what decisions has the artist made?
Yes.
And this is a great group of people, a massive, insane group of people who've all agreed that this is what's going to happen. And you're just enjoying them having made the right decisions.
Definitely.
What do you want? What do you want? You want food? Look at me. I just fell down a hill. I'm soaking wet. I don't have any food. I have no food on me. See, stick. Yeah, look, stick. Look, stick. Stick, stupid. That's a stick, boy. Look at stick. Yeah. You like your stick? You want to get it? And no wonder you're extinct.
And I think those decisions go beyond the dinosaurs are the main event.
Mm.
But I think the script has so much that is really interesting to think about in the context of Spielberg. Spielberg's all about family.
Yes.
And obviously, the family is the thing that goes through. Watching it last night was the first time I've ever thought about Lex and Tim's parents.
Yes, where are they?
Where are they? What? Yeah, the one reference we have is he says, "What, your dad never built you a treehouse?
Yeah.
And he goes, "No." Right.
Yeah. The nice guy is granddad.
Yeah.
Who risks your lives on an island full of monsters.
Yeah.
So yes, maybe the parents were eaten by. maybe the parents came last year.
Yeah.
But yes, the surrogate family is everything.
Yes.
This. The surrogate family, which is Laura Dern and Sam Neill,
mm-hmm.
their journey is the journey you're following. There's the classic unstated goal.
Mm-hmm.
Because the goal is we want to go to the island and find out what it's like. We're going on the adventure. And the unstated goal is don't you want kids?
Yes. Yeah.
And
that's
the one that at the end gets answered in the same way as Indiana Jones deserves the girl is the unanswered
journey. Yeah,
this one is are you two going to make good parents?
Yes.
That's the question.
If you wanted to scare the kid, you could have pulled a gun on him, you know.
Yeah, I know. Kids. You want to have one of those?
I don't want that kid, but a breed of child Dr. Grant could be intriguing.
And it's a great way of getting the family to sit down and watch the film together.
Yeah, no, really nice.
Because the kids know what family is.
Mm-hmm.
Grown-ups know what a family is. They're getting the same message.
Yeah.
If it was about sex, only the grown-ups would be interested in it.
Yeah.
If it was about toys, only the kids would be interested in it.
Yes.
Making it about family is a great way to make a family watch it together.
Mm.
So it asks a question, a classic Pixar question of what makes a good parent.
Yes.
The same question that's in Toy Story and Finding Nemo and everything. and the answer is, he left us. That thing of, that's what a bad parent does. And then a few scenes later,
he left us. He left us.
But that's not what I'm going to do.
That's not what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And it's the most like paternal.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it.
And he does the most parent during a scary story.
What if the dinosaurs come back while we're all asleep?
Well, I'll stay awake.
Go to sleep. I've been telling you a scary story, but I'll keep you safe.
I want to go now.
Just look how it eats.
Please.
I bet you never look at birds the same way again.
Yes. Go now.
Okay. Keep low and follow me.
This film with the wrong cast doesn't work.
Yeah?
Because you put traditional lantern-jawed heroic guy in the lead.
Mm.
You want someone with an interesting...
Yes.
I mean, Sam Neill's a good-looking fella.
Yeah.
But he's also...
Looks like a man as well.
Yeah. It's classic Spielberg in that it's indie film casting.
Mm,
As in, you've got an indie film cast of Jeff Goldblum, Sam Jackson, Wayne Knight.
Mm-hmm.
It's all indie people who'd be in a Coen Brothers film or Laura Dern's from David Lynch.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting indie film casting, and they've all got what Rufus Jones and I were saying, tin faces. As in, they look like they're from a cartoon.
Yeah.
You know who everyone is, the lawyer's got a thin face and yeah, Wayne's got a round face.
Mm-hmm.
They've got nice, easy faces to follow.
I love that. I love that Sam Neill, I panicked because I was like, I've always sort of seen Sam Neill as he's very paternal. And I was like, now's the time to Google, am I now older than Sam Neill was in this film? I'm not. I am not old, but like, there'll come a point and I will know that point, but it will be... Like
Spielberg dads, you should never look up Spielberg dads. I've lived most of my life obsessed by the one scene in Close Encounters where Richard Dreyfuss is a ratty dad with his kids because they won't go and see Pinocchio, which as a kid I thought was really important. That's really important. At some point, my kids won't want to go and see a film. And I looked up, I think he's about 32.
Oh my God.
And I went, but I base my entire idea of parenthood on that 32-year-old child.
Now,
I'm going to give you your choice. I'm not going to be biased in any way. Tomorrow night, you can either play goofy golf, which means a lot of waiting and shoving and pushing and probably getting a zero, or you can see Pinocchio, which is a lot of furry animals and magic, and you'll have a wonderful time. Okay? Now let's vote.
Golf! All right, everybody to bed.
I love... Also, it's really interesting and it's nice that the onus is on the... So obviously, there's the two narratives at the same time, which is like, there's an innate thing about procreation, which is then obviously the dinosaurs do as well. But like, that isn't on Laura Dern. It isn't when's Laura Dern going to become a mum.
Yeah.
It's about when will this guy who initially, and you can watch all the stage of that, he hates the kid at the start and he sort of bullies him.
Mm.
And then he sort of meets Lex and Tim and is irritated by them. And then you just see that sort of unravel as it happens. And the innateness, the kind of life will find a wayness of it, I guess, coming out.
They're noisy, they're messy, they're expensive.
Cheap, cheap.
They smell.
They do not
smell. Some of them smell. Baby smell.
There's moments, I feel like any podcast about Jurassic Park, you need to sort of, need to mention the moment which is passed around among sort of film buffs, which they love, which is they go, the bit in the helicopter where he can't get the thing.
Two female connectors. Now, this is worth doing because some people don't know this.
So in which case, then this is, it's just the most joyous thing in the world when someone points it out, isn't it? It's Glenn Close in Hook. It's where you go... It's the life finds a way, you know, in microcosm. Yeah, so you can probably explain it better, but it's...
They get into the helicopter.
Yeah.
We've established that Sam Neill's character is no good with technology.
Yeah.
You put him near computers, it's rubbish.
Mm-hmm.
To the point he's so bad with technology, he can't work a seatbelt.
Yeah.
So everyone else, they go, there's going to be some bumps in the helicopter as we descend to the island.
Mm.
So strap in, and they all go click, 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 rule of three. You see three seatbelts, and then Sam Neill pulls his out, and he's got two female connectors.
Yeah.
And that's the important thing. If you know about cars, you know those are two female connectors. Mm-hmm. And he can't get the two female connectors to go together.
Yeah.
So he ties them together to make a seatbelt.
Yeah.
Which is the theme of the film. if you've got lots of female dinosaurs who are not meant to breed, eventually someone will just tie them together and make the thing work. And it happens early on. It's a microcosm of the film done thematically. But you don't notice it because it's just a good character gag.
Yeah.
But if you were directing the film, you'd go, tee-hee.
Exactly. And it's rich in all of those little moments, which is just that little bit of extra effort you have to go to make something sort of resonate thematically all the way through.
Yeah, and actually, it's full of those moments which don't matter. If you don't get them, then it spoils the film. It's not obscure.
No.
That's a very obscure gag.
Yeah.
But again, you'll only get it on the third or fourth or fifth viewing or when someone points it out to you, which means, talking about comfort viewing, second or third time round, you know when the dinosaur's going to attack, but you're going to start noticing the lovely shots of the lunchboxes and things in Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
And you go, what a great, clever thing to put the merchandise for the film in the film. Product placement for our own stuff. I love that level.
Yeah.
The way that I noticed it this time around for the first time, again, it was criticised by critics to say it's shameless in its self-promotion.
Right,
It's about a theme park. Kids love theme parks.
Mm-hmm.
So put stuff kids like in it. The first shot you see isn't of a dinosaur. It's of a toy. It's of those amazing trucks. You go, I want to buy one of those trucks.
Yeah.
I want the Jeeps.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's changed with cinema, it's so brightly coloured.
I love it.
It's a toy set. It's brightly coloured. It's Lego. It's just the Jeeps are beautiful. You want to put the Jeeps in your mouth.
They are so
chewy.
I love the fact that when they go from... We're back in the car again, and that car is the most destroyed a car has ever been.
Yeah.
They cut straight back to a pristine one.
Yeah.
As well, to sort of go, the journey they've been on just in this way from this thing is like, oh, it's been completely destroyed, and here is a pristine one as well.
Don't forget, you can buy this. It's a real understanding, again, from understanding what kids like. This is the same thrill as you get watching Thunderbirds. The joy of Thunderbirds, the Gerry Anderson thing, was those vehicles. This is for kids who like to play with the toys.
Yes.
Show the toys. And what's John Hammond got a toy set. He's got the most amazing toy set with toy dinosaurs and toy cars. It's all about the joy of playing with it. And that play set is what Spielberg's got. He's enjoyed Spielberg Play Mountain. He is a player. He likes watching toys.
Yeah.
He builds big play sets. And the first thing you see in the film is one of those Jurassic Park branded Jeeps. And it's got a forklift, but it's not a forklift like you've seen.
Yeah,
It's as much fun as the Batmobile. It's just full of toys.
I would say that is one thing I was really impressed watching at this time is like how tactile everything is. When you have to convince someone that something exists when it isn't there, they go out of their way to go, but Jurassic Park is real and there's clunky locks and bolts and
ka-chung,
everything.
Ka-chung. Yeah. Oh, the threat when he realises that if you shut off the power, the door locks don't work.
Yeah.
They show you the door lock and go, that's the biggest lock I've ever seen.
National Weather Service is tracking a tropical storm about 75 miles west of us.
Oh, I tell you what, if that was working, that would keep dinosaurs out. I hope at some point that goes ka-chunk.
Yeah, exactly. There's so much ka-chunk in this film, and it's so sad. I love it.
Will you please shut down the system?
I'm sort of looking for those thematic things, and I love the fact that you, because I'd already heard you talk about Raiders and the idea of unfairness.
Yeah.
And I was the sleazy lawyer when he says, when he's talking about low income families going to see Jurassic Park, which is basically like 90% of the people watching it.
Yeah.
And he's like, we'll have a coupon day.
Yeah.
And you're like, screw you.
I hope you get eaten.
Yeah.
Laura, I mean, you're Scrooge.
Yeah.
You need that in a film. Mm. I think you need to feel someone's going to get eaten.
Mm.
And what you play with in films like this, especially you're doing this for kids, they need to kind of know that you won't hurt Sam Neill.
Yes.
And you won't hurt Jeff Goldblum. Mm-hmm. You won't hurt Laura Dern. And for God's sake, please don't hurt the kids.
Yeah.
You kind of trust that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
The moment they go for the lawyer, you go, oh, good, they're just going to do the bad guys.
Yeah,
then when they play a bait and switch with that and they hurt Sam Jackson, the whole audience jumps.
Yes. Yeah.
Because he didn't deserve it.
No.
That he was smoking.
He was, and that's his smoking arm, isn't it? I'm not sure. I don't think that was, it's not as sort of direct as that, but you go like,
it's bad for your health.
It is. Yeah. There was something going on there. I mean, Sam Jackson gets overlooked a lot for, you know, I mean, he's incredible. And this was,
I was thinking he'd probably be a pointless answer if he did cast a Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
People forget he's in this.
They do.
And he's wonderful in it.
He's crucial because he's the one selling the, you know, you've got people selling the threat of the dinosaurs and he's the one selling the threat of the technology failing. He's all the way through going, I love it. He goes, what the hell? It's a lovely
It's a really good double threat. I'd forgotten that. That's really well constructed in the screenplay. The two things that are threatening you are the dinosaurs, which of course are technology because they've...
True,
But there's nature's threatening you, but the real hubris is trusting the technology.
Yeah.
And they've trusted it to someone that there's a human problem.
Yeah.
And it's that greed,
mm-hmm.
someone will betray you.
Yeah.
And even then, actually, there's an implication which I hadn't spotted before, which where Wayne Knight meets the guy he's going to give the embryos to, and he says, don't be cheap with me. Pay the bill. Pay the bar bill.
Yeah.
Gracias, señor.
Don't get cheap on me, Dodson. That was Hammond's mistake.
You go, oh, you asked for a pay rise.
Yeah.
It's done in a tiny half line. Mm-hmm. You go, Hammond cut corners, didn't pay a little man what he asked for. Maybe he was being unreasonable, but this is revenge.
Yeah,
it's revenge for money. It's a beautiful character motive. It follows straight through. It's done in a half line.
Mm-hmm.
It's done brilliantly off. Pay my bill for the big cakes I'm eating.
Which, of course, then what's Hammond's catchphrase all the way through? We spared no expense. But he did. He didn't pay Dennis Nedry enough. And that's why it all went wrong.
And so basically the hacker, the geek, betrays him.
Mm-hmm.
So weirdly, you're watching a thing where there's, again, why it's not a monster movie.
Mm.
The monsters aren't a problem.
Yeah.
The real monster is man.
Yeah.
The people who are the problem are the fact that humans are flawed, which is why you mustn't tinker with nature again. Mm-hmm. Dennis Nedry not being paid is a chaotic element. It's what Malcolm keeps saying.
Yeah.
Jeff Goldblum keeps warning them, something will go wrong. A butterfly will flap its wings.
Yeah.
And the whole story is a tiny, tiny mistake on the part of Hammond leads to children being threatened by dinosaurs. You can't trust it. There's an interesting thing about Ian Malcolm as a character as well, because he's meant to be there as an exposition dump.
Yes.
I think he's meant to be the chaos bits from the book.
Yeah.
And they make him a really, really interesting character. And as Sam Neill said, not the character they thought was going to turn up on set.
Interesting.
Because he's written as a nerd.
Yeah.
And he turns up and he's ripped. And he keeps opening his shirt. And you go, there's a sort of, when you see Sam Neill interviewed about it, there's a bit of a, Oh, I mean, literally, the chaotic element was Jeff Goldblum deciding to do him as a hero?
Yeah.
Samuel's going, there's another hero?
Well, I mean, would you, you know, you should write him out. Like, doesn't all screenwriting, like, logic say write out Ian Malcolm because you have Sam Neill and he's sort of, he's rendered immobile for, like, the second half of the film. Or he would die, really. That's the...
According to the interviews, it's the, this is the classic thing, you go, was this fun or was this not fun? Mm. Apparently, he's supposed to run off with the lawyer to the toilets and hide. Because you see him, he's buried in rubble.
Yeah.
He's supposed to run off and hide. And Jeff Goldblum did that classic actor's thing of going, do you know what would be more interesting? Is if my character didn't run off and hide and did something really heroic and waved a flare? And Samuel was going, what? So I turn around, I'm waving a flare, I'm being the dad, and there's another dad? And it's the classic thing of going, I think I'd like my character to also be the hero. But weirdly, I watched it again and forgotten how thrilling it is for this guy who's very cynical and is saying this isn't going to work to suddenly step up and be
an
uncle.
Yes. Yeah, and you go,
and weirdly, it makes the kids feel safer.
Uh-huh.
Because there's two grown-ups.
Yeah,
so you know
And
I think it's a selfish actor's decision, wanting a bit more focus.
Definitely.
But weirdly, it does really work. When you see him waving that flare, again, you punch the air. It's you've got Luke Skywalker, but Han Solo's on side as well.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, great.
That's true. Yeah, it's the Han Solo aspect of it. And like that Jeep chase wouldn't be the same if it was two people facing forwards. You have to have the one person who's like looking the danger in the eyes as they...
And it's brilliant. He plays it brilliantly.
Must go faster.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was pure vanity, but the effect, I think...
Mm.
Spielberg seems to be quite good at taking actors' notes, which is why he's so good with Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
Someone who's going, I don't think I'd do that. Spielberg is very good at saying... Yeah, let's see where that goes.
Yeah.
And actually, I think it speaks well of him, I think, as a director and a collaborator.
Definitely.
Not a super auteur, not as someone who says, but it says in the script, do this.
Yeah.
He's prepared to then re-engineer it. I imagine if you talk to David Koepp, you go, it was a nightmare 4 days putting Ian Malcolm in the script as an action hero ripped to the waist.
Yeah.
But it works.
Yes. And that, I mean, think about a film as well where there's not a lot of room for, you don't want people suddenly improvising. So the fact that Spielberg was willing to like throw his arms open and go, sure. Okay, you know, they need to be absolutely have every shot mapped out for certain sequences and things. That's incredible.
Most of this has been done in stop motion.
Yeah.
There's no room for you to be in it. It's a terrific, I mean, I said this about Raiders as well.
Yeah.
It's a big blockbuster film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's made out of tiny plays, little tiny chamber pieces. I watched it and went, oh, wow. There's a version of this, which again, they go for maybe in the later ones.
Yeah.
Where there are bigger groups of people.
Yes.
Where there could be a theme park full of members of the public. A disaster movie could have a massive cast.
Yeah.
But it constantly breaks them into two-handers and three-handers.
Mm-hmm.
Each Jeep has got different people in it.
Yeah.
And you get to see, what does it look like if the kid is talking to Sam Neill?
Mm.
What does it look like if Laura Dern is there with Jeff Goldblum? It's a series of little two- and three-hander plays.
Yeah.
The people who are in the control room.
Mm-hmm.
Against the people who are out in the...
Yeah.
It's really controlled.
And it means each scene is like, it is a perfect length. It means that you're cutting between all of them. And like that, the play one is Laura Dern and Richard Attenborough when they just have that conversation, which is is pure emotion and dialogue and just they're intellectualizing the problem.
It's all an illusion.
When we have control again.
You've never had control. That's the illusion. I was overwhelmed by the power of this place, but I made a mistake too. I didn't have enough respect for that power, and it's out now.
Yeah. And I wonder if that scene would exist if this was made later.
Yeah.
I love the bit where John Hammond turns up and pops their champagne.
Yes.
I love the arrogance of, I love the fact that he hasn't earned that. And it's his character, isn't it? His character is someone who goes, I'm a showman and I've done this thing and here's the popping the champagne.
They're all covered in dust.
Yeah. He's like, no, they've been working and they're like, we were saving that because they do small bits of hard work and reward themselves.
Yeah.
Whereas he wants all of the reward and everything, and that's his sort of hubris, and that's his problem.
There's his journey you're going to watch. But they're all, I mean, this is a big blockbuster film at the peak of Spielberg's big blockbuster.
Yeah.
But it's not full of massive scenes. This is, again, the thing he learned from not doing 1941 again. To reduce your blockbuster cast down to the smallest possible things. A Winnebago with three people in it and a champagne. And I wonder if that's the thing that you forget about this era of Hollywood is it comes out of the 70s new cinema.
Yeah.
Which is very New York theatre thing.
Yeah.
You forget these guys were watching that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all to do with little two and three handers. It's all to do with that. the drama of loads and loads of short scenes. And I think as a screenwriter, you can learn loads from this, going, you've got to move a blockbuster forwards.
Yeah.
But all you can do is put three people in a room.
Yeah.
And the next one, put three people in a room.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no coincidence that the blockbuster cinema of today that seems to work best isn't the Wagnerian side stuff. It's when Marvel gets people who were trained in sitcom to do a string of scenes where three people talk to each other.
Yeah.
Those, I love those ones, but because that's from this heritage.
Definitely. And they can be aliens, they can be painted blue, but if they've got a point of view and they're funny or they're sort of witty, then that's what you want to watch.
Jurassic Park, it's a scary film.
Yeah.
But it's 100% for kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's meant to be what it was for you. The scariest film you ever seen as a kid. So how does that work? What's it doing to be this scary but totally kid-friendly?
It's strange, isn't it? Like, I think there's something about, you know, when they're going on the tour and then they stop the tour because they want to see more of it, and so they break it. And it goes, and so from then on, everything's like off the rails.
Yes.
And there's a real feeling of things going off the rails.
Yeah.
And I think there's so much that says, like, there's so many things when you're a kid that are on rails and say you're safe. And there is something so thrilling about, like, the first adult they have leaves. And there's just things where you go, all these comfort things that you have around you are stripped away. But you have the parents. So, I love the fact they don't have locking mechanisms on the vehicle doors. Like,
that's a brilliant line.
Yeah.
Is it Bob Peck? I told you we should put locks on the doors.
Yeah.
Why don't you?
Yeah, it's insane that they don't do that.
Listen to Bob Peck.
Yeah.
He's half dinosaur. Yeah.
So, like, I think there is something, the fantasy of being, like, on a roller coaster that goes wrong.
Yes.
And I think that that is what it's playing with.
Yeah, because it's a theme park. The point about theme parks is they're safe.
Yes, exactly.
And this says, what if you went to a theme park that was... Again, it's using language most kids understand. Kids have been taken on tours.
Yes.
Kids have been taken to a castle and your mum has said, don't climb over the railings.
Yeah.
It's about a school trip where the school trip goes wrong.
Yeah.
Which, again, is a language you realise when you're writing for kids that sometimes you can't put things in to films that because kids don't understand them.
Got you. Yeah.
Kids have got a very limited understanding of money. Kids don't do money.
So yes.
Kids don't care.
They don't get it.
They care about cake.
Yes.
They care about fairground rides, and you want to do things that kids understand, and kids understand being told off.
Yes, yeah,
they understand
yeah.
naughtiness, mm-hmm. and they understand. It just occurred to me, they understand school trips.
Yes, yeah.
This is you've gone to Hampton Court, and someone said that's a very high railing.
You've
climbed over it, and it's just about that.
And it's really, and because I forget that there's so much of it is doing the tour and then breaking off. So they do the boring tour that you do with your parents, where like they go, this thing is here, I can't see it. Because I'd imagine as a kid, when you do those things, you can never see anything because you're surrounded by adults and you can never get the vantage point. So they go, oh, this is boring. So the first thing they do is get out the cars and they go and find the Triceratops.
Yeah.
And they interact with it. And that's great because that's wish fulfillment, right?
The fantasy is that you'd... Yeah. And again, especially for kids as well, when kids go to the zoo.
Mm.
And the first time as a kid, you're told, you know, you can't get in the cages with the animals. Yeah. You go, what was the point of the zoo? I can't go and cuddle the panda. What's the point?
Yeah.
I can do that with soft toys.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's a toy set. And they get to go to the Triceratops. The Triceratops is adorable. It's a brilliant build.
Mm-hmm.
Such an empathetic model.
Yeah.
There's a poo joke. Everything about it says, this is your best day on the farm ever.
Yeah.
You get to go and pet the cows. It's a petting zoo.
Yeah, it really
is. Triceratops is the petting. They even call it, she calls it a trike.
You know, if it's all right, I'd like to stay with Dr. Harding and finish up with the trike. If, you know.
Sure, I'm in a gas-powered Jeep.
Oh, yeah.
Now I love it.
That's
I'm going to stay here with a trike. And you went, what, like a toy? Like a trike, like a toy. It's a bit that goes, this crosses over with vets, zoos, lots of stuff that kids understand.
Yes.
Again, it's the language of kids that kids get. Kids always say they want to grow up and work with animals.
Yeah.
And it pulls it back from, it's not a monster movie, it's a zoo movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's a zoo goes wrong.
Yeah.
A crazy zoo film. And it's all in language kids understand. Kids have had sick pets.
Yes.
This all works and you go, oh, the biggest, most magical sick pet in the world. It's wonderful. Spielberg understands this stuff.
Yeah.
Very often he's working in genres that he would have watched as a child. It took me ages to work out. E.T. is a boy and his dog film.
Oh, yeah.
Mum says you can't have a dog.
Boy
gets a dog. Dog is secret. Dog gets sick.
Yeah.
Dog has to go to live on a farm.
Yes, yeah.
That's E.T.,
mm-hmm.
but with an alien. But he does really clever spins on sentimental movies he might have seen growing up.
Yeah.
And this is Adventure on a Zoo.
Yeah.
It's a classic kids' adventure movie in that sense.
That's great! That's a cut right there. Great! Fabulous!
Okay. Great.
It was very important to me to be a kid directing Jurassic Park.
And the kids are central to it, and you mm-hmm. follow the kids through.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time it's their reactions. They, again, like the grown-ups get to have awe and pull their glasses off yeah. and see the Brachiosaurus. But the kids get to scream. And I suppose as a kid, that's your prompt.
Yeah,
when
yeah.
they scream, you scream. You know
it. Which makes it fascinating that the kids turn up. I think I clocked it. It's like 22 minutes in
right.
that Lex and Tim turn up. Yeah. And I wonder if that's just when you need to... Just when you need that sort of shot of, like, I don't know, the plot needs to sort of...
Identification, or the kids need to have a hero.
Exactly, yeah. And so we just need that to then... Because we're introduced to everyone else, and we're introduced to all the adults.
Yeah.
What's really interesting as well, it is from a kid's point of view, they don't shirk on adult relationships in the sense that, like, you know, Dr. Sattler and Sam Neill and Laura Dern...
Mm.
Their relationship is sort of ill-defined,
yeah.
which is quite... But interesting, you know, I think they're going out, but it's never really said.
Oh, I think as well, again, talking about this from a kid's point of view,
yeah.
that's roughly how kids understand relationships.
It is, yeah.
It would be pointless if they went into the detail that the kids wouldn't get it. Kids
no.
get a vague feeling their parents like each other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or
yeah.
that they're going... Or that dad's got a new girlfriend. They
yeah.
don't... You don't want to know.
Doesn't matter.
The kids come in,
mm.
and then you watch them have the adventure, and you watch mm. their eyes, and you watch their faces, and they react, and they mm. react generally in... fear when abandoned by the grown-ups.
Yeah,
that's what
yeah,
you're
yeah.
watching mainly.
Yeah.
He left us.
Also, I noticed as well, there's no blood.
No.
There's a lot of chomping and no yeah. blood. There's blood in Jurassic Park 2, which yes. makes it a higher certificate film, I think.
Yeah.
But Jurassic Park 1, there's no blood.
Mm-hmm.
Even at the beginning when the guy gets pulled in. In Jaws,
yeah.
there would be blood when
spraying
he gets pulled
out. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's blood on the kids' faces.
Oh, yeah.
In the car accident.
Yeah.
And that's the only blood you see is mm-hmm. on the kids.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's quite an odd decision.
Mm-hmm.
It says they've been injured.
Yeah.
So you oh, we're in trouble.
Mm.
But the lawyer gets eaten by a
It's a bit clean, isn't it? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's just chomping.
Yeah, yeah.
It's again,
mm.
when you watch these movies and you realise they're for kids, they move and interact in the way you do with toys.
Mm-hmm.
That the toy of the lawyer, the minifigure yeah, yeah. of the toy, goes into the mouth of the tyrannosaur.
And it's gone. Yeah,
and
yeah,
it's
yeah.
gone. It's just that. But there's blood on the face of the kids. And I think you're meant to go, oh!
I like that. I love it when... I think that also kids feel like they're not being talked down to when you put the kids in the films through the ringer.
Yes.
Obviously, there's a limit to, like, what that... It should be sort of physical danger, you know,
yeah.
but... And maybe a bit of... Because obviously Tim really gets electrocuted and all this
yeah.
other stuff, and he's, like, limping by the end and all that. But kids love it because kids get... They throw themselves around and they pretend,
yeah.
they mime getting... Stabbing each other and stuff all the time.
It means they're having the adventure with the grown-ups.
Exactly.
They're not spared
yeah.
from it. Yeah, the kids aren't running around on the end of the grown-up's arm.
No, they're in not, there, aren't they? Yeah,
they're not being rescued. They're not the prize.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not being fought over.
Yes,
they're
yeah.
in it. And mm-hmm. certainly when the T-Rex attack in the paddock,
mm-hmm.
when they're under that sheet of glass.
Yeah,
genuinely brilliant bit of peril.
Yeah,
they're being hammered on, and there's a tiny bit of glass
yeah.
between them. And that I wasn't watching that going, this is too much for kids.
They're constantly screaming. And in reality, those children wouldn't, you know, because this is a movie, you can enjoy it. Those children would never be the same again if they
yeah.
were in real life.
You're watching traumatised kids, but
yeah.
that's a strange thing. You watched this as a kid
mm.
and said you'd never been so scared.
Yeah.
But come away and now it's a source of comfort.
You earn your stripes. I think you earn your stripes.
Ah, right.
I think you go, like, you take a deep breath and you could not be more safe at the end of that film. They are in the arms of Sam Neill. They
yeah.
are in the thing. Everyone's surrounded by it. It's calm. There are birds. There's that beautiful piano.
Yeah.
And they go, you could not be more safe. And you made it through. You
yeah.
made it through Jurassic. And I think as a kid, there's a bit of like, I earned my stripes there.
I made it through the film.
Yeah.
The kids made it through the adventure.
Yeah.
You made it through the film.
Mm-hmm.
And now, yeah, maybe mm-hmm. your parents would let you watch some other
films. Yeah, it's about growing up. It's this stage of evolution, if you will. You know, it's
yeah.
it's growing up. And I think that that's really nice. So then they go, well, if you manage that, maybe next week we'll try X.
Even if one of them survives, what will be left? The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
It's about growing up. It's about saying, we wouldn't have shown this to you when you were younger.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's a lovely... I mean, Spielberg is very good for those.
Mm-hmm.
There's an order to watch the films in.
Yeah,
you'll
yeah,
watch
yeah.
E.T. when you're smaller.
Yeah.
And that's genuinely frightening. The best friend dies.
Yeah,
feels like he's
yeah,
died.
Yeah.
You'll move beyond cartoons. You stop watching Disney, you start
yeah.
watching this. But with this, there's a brilliantly judged sense of saying this is a rite of passage.
Yeah, yeah.
Watch the scary movie.
Mm-hmm.
A movie in which nothing happens except children scream. And we trust you to not be frightened.
It's love. Yeah, basically. I'm sure over the course of the podcast, you'll talk a lot about the Spielberg thing and his the way that he just taps into perfectly what's the perfect amount of peril, or, you know, that a child can take, and then what's one dial above that?
Yes.
What's, like, probably what's acceptable, and then just tip it over a bit. The end of Raiders is too scary for the kids who've enjoyed it all the way through.
Totally.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
But they've earned it.
You put your hands over your eyes. Yeah. There's that feeling of being trusted to take it. It's a very skilled director, and it's an adult, and he's at the peak of his powers.
Yeah.
But he's directing it with the eye of a child for himself as a child.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think that makes it a very pure, very uncynical film.
Definitely.
And a film that you respond to, and you obviously responded to as a child.
Yeah.
Saying, oh, this is for me. It's he's the kid with a torch under his chin, telling his friends the scariest story he can, and going halfway through, and do you know who it happened to? Us.
I think that's why, looking back, and when you think about like a comfort blanket, something that you find comfort in, you're also finding comfort, one, in your own bravery. You go like, I made it through, and this is, and that's my reward. And so you kind of hug that tight, the fact that you're like, that was a moment in your life when you were really scared.
Yeah.
And you made it through, and now it's something that you can go, I own that. And that's my, and it, you get a warm feeling of being like brave or surviving it, or being like, and that's what I get from it. I get like this feeling of just, firstly, it's a precision engineered beautifully. So you know, you always know you're in safe hands, but it's going, I made it through, I've done that, and then you can sort of hold that tight and be like proud of yourself and get that warm feeling of like pride that you get from it.
That's a lovely definition of comfort, because comfort isn't about safety.
Yeah.
Comfort is sometimes about having got through danger.
Yeah.
And got out at the end, and you're in the arms of Sam Neill in a helicopter watching some beautiful pelicans fly past.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
With a lovely piano.
Oh, it's wonderful.
What a lovely place to end. We're back in the arms of Sam Neill.
what a wonderful place to be.
Thank you for bringing Jurassic Park.
Thank you.
Comfort Blanket was presented and produced by Joel Morris for the Cheese and Pickle family of podcasts. Find us on social media and don't forget to like and subscribe.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.